Welcome to another episode of Daughters of Mormonism. I'm your host, Sybil. Today, we'll be talking more with Julianne about the talk that she gave about the temple and also about her history as a convert to the church. Welcome back, Julianne.
Thank you.
Let's start off with you telling us about you. Tell us about the capsule of your life story and especially your history with the church, how and why you converted, and we'll go from there.
So I grew up in Germany in a semi-spiritual but non-religious home. I always felt that there was a God, and while I was Catholic on paper and went to Catholic high school, I never felt any church fit my beliefs. When I was studying for my final exams in high school, two LDS missionaries rang my doorbell. I still remember answering the door with a huge chocolate ice cream stain on my hoodie and answering the missionary's question whether or not I was happy with a resounding yes. Can't you tell? I've just had a big bowl of chocolate ice cream. How could my life not be totally fabulous? So that was my first contact with the church, and they gave me a Book of Mormon, which I didn't read. They sporadically came to visit me, but I wasn't really interested. And then after high school, I worked at a bakery for a while before college. And one Monday night, a guy came in with his mother. I knew who he was, and I was acquainted with his mother. But we had gone to different high schools, and so I'd never talked to him personally. I talked to his mom for a bit while stealing glances at him. And after they left, I thought, oh, it would be so cool if he came back and asked me out. But, you know, this kind of stuff only happens in movies, right?
So, right.
So 5 minutes before I closed, he came back to the store and asked me out. We started dating, and I started attending church with him because I wanted to know why he was so strange. Strange in a good way. So more like peculiar and interesting.
So he was a member of the church?
He was the only boy my age in the only family who were members of the church in my tiny little hometown. So yes, he was a member, and I started going to church with him. But investigating the church while dating him was sometimes really hard on our relationship because he had a really strong testimony and frustrated with my persistent questioning and doubting of some core doctrines or issues with church history. You know, equality, priesthood, polygamy, the usual suspects. So I left for college and kept investigating the church in my college town. And there I met many missionaries, one of whom would eventually become my husband. My boyfriend, who was back home, broke up with me shortly after I started college, a few months before he went on his mission. But I still kept investigating the church, realizing that I was doing it for myself and not for him. And my future husband, Tori, was actually the first missionary who had introduced himself to me in my new college town when I went to church there for the first time. I still remember that moment that I shook his hand, and it was an almost instant connection for me, but not in a romantic way. I just felt like he was a kindred spirit. So anyway, I kept meeting with missionaries for about 8 months, and then I transferred to a different college in a different town, in a different state, actually. And Tori and I started writing to each other, and I fell in love with him through letters. He wrote the most beautiful letters. Little did I know that it took him his whole P-Day to write one of those. He did a great job, so it worked for me. And after about 18 months of investigating the church, I decided to get baptized. I remember that I did not have any special revelation or anything. I just felt it was the next step and the right thing for me to do at the time. I thought that eventually I would grow in the gospel to understand all those doctrines that caused me pain and confusion. So I went ahead with it. I got baptized by a really good friend with members from all the different wards that I had attended and many non-member relatives and friends in attendance. And it was a really happy occasion for me. And Tori, of course, wasn't allowed to attend since we were in different missions at the time. So after that, I decided to stop writing Tori because I didn't want to distract him from his mission. And months later, when he was nearing the end of his mission, I was going to visit my father's side of the family on the East Coast. And so I contacted Tori's parents to see if I could come to Montana to be there when Tori got off the plane after his mission. After making sure that I wasn't some psycho stalker chick, they graciously invited me to come. And I did. I arrived in Montana August 7th, 2003 in the afternoon, met most of Tori's family, and then went straight back to the airport with them to pick up Tori, who got home from his mission that same day. And I don't think I've ever been in a more awkward situation with the whole family watching our every move. We had a very, very awkward handshake at the airport.
I'll bet.
We weren't allowed to hug. You know, he later told me that he totally was going in for a hug, and I just extended my hand all properly and said, "You're allowed to shake my hand," or something silly like that. But that's what we did. And then we spent a few days together. And a week later, we all went to Portland, Oregon together because his sister was getting married there, and she had waited for him to come home from his mission so he could be there. So exactly a week after he came home from his mission and I saw him again for the first time, he proposed to me on the temple grounds in Portland. And I said yes. And so 3 days later, I went back to Germany with a ring on my finger and had to explain to my family and friends there who this guy was that I was planning to marry. I was going to finish out the semester, but instead I packed up all my stuff and moved to the States at the end of September. And I think my German family and friends were in shock. I'm surprised at how supportive and happy they were for me, mostly because if it was one of my relatives, one of my daughters or nieces or friends, I would have gone insane. My mom was actually the only one who had ever met Tori, and that was only once while he was still a missionary. So no one else knew him. And understandably, they were really surprised at my decisions to get baptized into a very conservative church after growing up in a very liberal home, then getting engaged to a man that I barely knew and that they'd never met, and then move to a different continent and get married in a ceremony that none of them would be able to attend. So the next year in 2004 in the Billings Temple, none of my family was present in the temple, of course. My brother came to the temple and waited there in the waiting room. And my brother and two aunts came to the reception, but neither one of my parents did, and none of my German family or friends could make it. So I really felt like I left everything behind for this new life. And at the time, I felt like a pioneer. I felt like I was nobly sacrificing everything to do what I thought was the right thing for me to do. And I can't say that I regret what I did, but I definitely viewed it differently from how I view it now. Now we have 4 little girls, and we still live in Montana. And for most of our married years, I tried very hard to be the perfect Molly Mormon, but it just never worked for me. We've been married for a little over 7 years, and a few years ago, I was at my lowest point. It was after I gave birth to our 4th daughter. When she was born, our oldest one was still 2 and in diapers. We had 2-year-olds who was getting ready to turn 3. We had twins that were 1 year old, and then we just had a newborn.
My goodness.
I was in the hospital scared to go home because I knew I couldn't handle it. At that point, I was almost 40 pounds overweight. I was severely depressed. I literally cried every single day. I dragged myself through the day, waiting for my kids to go to bed. I yelled a lot. I felt no connection to my husband. I had stopped everything that I liked doing. I stopped writing. I stopped dancing. I stopped painting. I had absolutely no friends that weren't Mormon. My whole network was all inside the church. And I just didn't recognize that shell of a person when I looked in the mirror. I have this picture of myself sitting on the kitchen floor crying and one of my girls coming up to me, giving me a hug. It must have been Victoria because she was the oldest one and really worried about why I was so sad. And she couldn't really communicate that because she was so little and I couldn't really comfort her. And it was such a terrible feeling that I felt like I had tried so hard to do everything right. But still, I wasn't happy. I felt like I'd given up myself and I didn't know who I was anymore. And so at that point, I knew I had to do something. So very slowly, I started getting better. I started eating better. I started exercising. I started writing to get stuff out of my head. I read books for pleasure again. I tried to meet new people. You know, eventually, I started doing things that I liked, like dancing and running and preparing to run races just to kind of challenge myself. Eventually, I started feeling better and started to recognize myself again. And just recently, I went back to school to finish my degree. That helped me to get to know people that were not in my regular circle of friends who had different views and opinions who I could openly talk to without being judged because I wasn't giving the right answers.
That's quite the story. as I listened, I could feel the overwhelm of being a young mother with four children under the age of three. That's just such an astonishing, I can totally feel the trappedness.
It's insane. Let's call it what it is. It's insane. When our twins were born, I could not go anywhere. I literally did not leave the house for 6 months because our oldest one, Victoria, had just started walking. I couldn't leave the house because I had one car seat in each hand, and then I didn't have an extra hand to hold on to Victoria. So I literally was trapped inside the house for like half a year. I was completely dependent on people helping me out with everything. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm not grateful for my kids. I am so, so grateful for them. I am grateful that with all of them, I felt very strongly prompted that they needed to come to our family at that time. And so I do not regret making that choice, but I feel that I could have handled it differently in a better, healthier way if I hadn't been so completely tangled up in especially the idea of perfectionism that is so very prevalent among the women of the church, where it's not about being perfected in Christ anymore, but, you know, kind of being perfect by yourself. Like, you can get into heaven by making enough casseroles for sick people and pregnant women. I mean, we don't get into heaven by helping the 13th family move or going to every Super Saturday there is. I mean, I just was so focused on doing all the right things and being this perfect little version of a Mormon woman that wasn't me. I don't know why I tried so hard to fit that mold. And it's not like anybody told me to do that. I made that choice. I made that choice based on what I heard church leaders tell me that I should do. I mean, they definitely influenced me in that choice that I made, but I understand that it was still my choice. I still decided to not live true to who I was, but instead try to be somebody that I wasn't. And once I realized that, I could change.
Let's move back in your story a little bit. Tell us about what drew you to the church. You said that you came from a fairly liberal upbringing, and then you ended up joining, as you say, a very conservative church. What is it that drew you to the Mormon church?
There's three main things that drew me to the church. One, eternal families. Two, the idea of a heavenly mother. And three, personal revelation. So those were the three doctrines that really resonated with me that I hadn't found in any other church. And coming from a family that was separated by divorce, my parents got divorced when I was 7, and with members of my family living scattered on two different continents, with my mom being German and me and my brother growing up in Germany and having our little family there, then my father being American and eventually moving back to the States and his whole side of the family being over there, I just felt a strong desire to gather my family together and create a close-knit family of my own. So not being able to be with all of my family in this life, the concept of eternal families in heaven gave me a hope that eventually I would not be separated from the people that I loved anymore. Secondly, I'd always believed that God was both female and male. So when I heard about the doctrine of a heavenly mother, I was definitely intrigued. I had never heard of a Christian church that believed in a female goddess equal to a male god. And then lastly, personal revelation and agency just felt really true for me. I embraced this doctrine to mean that I could have a personal, intimate relationship with God, that I didn't need to go through a priest or a middleman to get to God, but that he, she would commune with me directly.
Those are beautiful, the doctrines that really drew you. How do you feel about those same things now?
I still love those doctrines. I love my family, and I believe that we will be together forever. I just lost my Opa, my German grandpa, who I was very close to, and I also believe that I will be with him in the eternities, even though he's not a member. So I believe in eternal families, but that the church teaches that you have to be sealed to each other in the temple in order for that to happen. I think that there are many, many people who believe in the concept of eternal families without ever having heard of the temple. I just can't see going to heaven and then God telling me, well, I'm sorry, you can only be with the members that are officially sealed to you. We'll just keep all the other people that you love away from you. I still believe in that concept of eternal families, but I probably don't see it the way that it is taught in the church. When it comes to Heavenly Mother, I more strongly than ever believe that there is a divine feminine. I'm not sure if I believe God to be heavenly parents, a distinct mother and father, or if I feel there is one God that incorporates both female and male without being separate beings. The picture that comes to my mind is that yin-yang symbol that represents male and female energy in perfect harmony. When it comes to personal revelation, I've realized that what I want is communion with God. And at this point in my life, I've just decided to do whatever helps me to feel closer to that source. I don't pray or read my scriptures regularly or in the way that the church deems appropriate. I have addressed prayers to both my heavenly parents, from which President Hinckley strongly discouraged members. I don't kneel down or use the thou language. My style of prayer, I think, is more along the lines of pondering, of meditating, of just being still enough so I can feel the connection. And what I've realized is that this whole time I have looked outside myself for personal revelation, and now I look inside. So for me, communion with God is not something anymore that comes from the outside into my being, but that happens from the inside out. So maybe it's what we sometimes call the light of Christ. It, to me, feels more like an inner compass that shows the way rather than an outward traffic sign that I have to follow.
That's a really beautiful description of prayer and receiving revelation. I like that. When we were in the preparation phases for this podcast, you mentioned something about how doctrines are presented differently to investigators than to members. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. For me, the main difference was that before I joined the church, everything was fair game when it came to questions. Nothing was taboo, and I got to voice concerns about everything without being reprimanded or judged for it. The current advertising campaign, actually, that the church is using right now, it's called I'm a Mormon, illustrates my opinion rather well. Those are those short clips of members of the church that speak about their lives, and then at the end they say, and I'm a Mormon. These clips, in my opinion, present the church as very mainstream Christian church with very basic beliefs that most people can agree on and are based on the testimony and life stories of these people who seem to be very diverse and often untraditional members, you know, like single parents and working mothers and people like that. So these clips, to me, give the impression that we as a church are encouraging diversity, when in my experience in the church, the pressure to conform into a homogenous mass was always far greater than the focus on diversity and uniqueness. So before I joined the church, the eternal family doctrine, for example, gave me hope. After joining, the way it was taught made me feel more like my family would forever be separated because I was the only member in my family. And it placed a huge burden of responsibility on my shoulders, thinking that I had to convert my whole family. Maybe I could just keep going with those examples of the doctrines that drew me into the church, the way that they were presented to me before, and the way that I felt they were taught after. The concept of eternal families was one thing that drew me in, but later actually the way it was taught caused me a lot of pain and confusion. Same was with the concept of a heavenly mother. Before I joined the church, I was really excited that the church acknowledged the existence of heavenly mother. But after I joined the church, I quickly learned that we don't talk about her, we don't question her role, and we most certainly do not pray to her. It makes no sense to me to have a mother if I'm not allowed to have contact with her. I mean, what's the point? How would I expect my children to feel toward me if they never had any contact with me? Sometimes I'm just frightened by the parallels I see of how Heavenly Mother is treated in the church and how LDS mothers are treated in the church. The mother exists and she's so special and she's so holy, but we can't actually worship her the way she deserves it or respect her the way she deserves it. We can't communicate with her. She's the silent one in the background that we sort of know about but don't have access to. Instead, all the communication has to go through the father. And even though she's supposedly a goddess equal to father, she is not a member of the Godhead. So what does that mean? Does that mean that she's an inferior goddess? Then there is a whole issue of polygamy, and if there's polygamy in heaven, couldn't Heavenly Father also have more than one wife? You know, are we children of different Heavenly Mothers? I have so many questions about the divine feminine and so few answers because there's not much knowledge at all that is considered official church doctrine. And questions such as these that I just asked, which I think are perfectly legitimate questions to ask, those things are not only discouraged, but they can threaten your membership in the church. And members of the church, like, for example, Margaret Toscano, have been punished with excommunication for exploring similar questions and discussing their findings publicly. Do we do that to our own children? Do we disown them for wanting to know who their mother is? It's crazy to me. I'm starting to think that while the concept of a Heavenly Mother attracted me at first, I am looking for a different feminine divine whose sole role is not just mothering, but simply being woman. And I want somebody who's accessible to me and truly equal to the male divine. I've heard that Heavenly Father doesn't really reveal anything about mother because she needs to be protected and he loves her so much that he doesn't want their kids, you know, us, to defile her name and so forth. And I have to tell you, I think that's BS. I don't buy it at all. I think Heavenly Mother as a goddess can take care of herself, that she is strong enough to keep loving her children no matter how angry they might get at her. If I think about myself, do I stop loving my kids when they slam doors and tell me that they hate me, that they would rather have a different mother, that they're going to go run away and find a different family? Of course not. Does it hurt? Yes. But I would always, always, always take the risk of getting hurt in order to also have all the sweet moments of intimacy and love with them that are part of parenting as well. And in no way do I believe that Heavenly Mother would give up on a relationship with her children under any circumstance, especially this notion that she needs to be protected from her own kids. This concept of the feminine divine has probably caused me the most confusion so far. When it comes to personal revelation, before I joined the church, I was really excited about the church acknowledging each individual's conscience and relationship with God and right to choose. But after joining the church, I felt that there was always a strong dialectic tension between personal revelation and following the prophet. And it seemed to me that personal revelation was only considered valid as long as it lined up with the prophet's counsel. So if one were to receive revelation contrary to the prophet, that person must necessarily be wrong, even when it's regarding very personal matters, such as marriage or childbearing, career choices, parenting, sex, sexual orientation, and so forth. So I felt increasingly claustrophobic, like I wasn't allowed to break out of the framework the church set for all members, and that I couldn't criticize leaders for speaking what I didn't consider divine truth, but merely personal opinion or cultural traditions. And Elder Dallin H. Oaks, that PBS special about Mormons, he said, "It is wrong to criticize church leaders, even if the criticism is true. This makes me sick to my stomach. I understand that, of course, it's wrong to personally insult somebody, but not allowing members to criticize leadership and church policies by calling it evil speaking of the Lord's anointed is not a psychologically healthy way to run a church or any organization, in my opinion." Just talking about those three basic things that attracted me to the church in the first place, I have definitely realized that they are taught a little bit differently from the pulpit on any given Sunday and in our church materials than what I thought they were before I joined the church.
I think you make a really important point that when you're an investigator, your questions are welcomed. You get to ask all the questions you want, but once you've joined the church, you're supposed to hold your questions inside and toe the line. I agree with you. That's psychologically very unhealthy. And to not be able to say, hey, I don't like this, this hurts me, or I think you're wrong, and to have anything that you say along those lines be classified immediately as evil speaking, that's not evil speaking. It's just genuinely saying, I don't like this. I think you're wrong. So, yeah, I think that there's definitely a sort of interesting double standard. We're so willing to answer the questions of the investigators, but the members, they don't get their questions answered.
That's true. And when I heard that quote by Elder Oaks, I thought, well, maybe this was taken out of context. You know, maybe that's not really what he meant. But there is actually a talk on LDS.org given by him. It is titled Criticism. And he goes into this topic in depth. And he really feels that the church is not a democratic organization where people can voice their criticism like that, which really scared me. That this is really what he means, that we cannot criticize even if the criticism is true. I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, but it turns out that's actually what he meant.
This leads pretty well into the fact that you were brave enough to give your talk about the temple to your ward, wherein you expressed a long series of your questions that you'd been holding inside since you joined the church. The different questions and issues and cognitive dissonance and paradoxes and places that were simply confusing, those things sort of came out in this talk. I'd like to talk more about what happened after you gave your talk. First of all, what was the immediate response?
I had a lot more questions than what I expressed in my talk, but a lot of them were very specific to different temple ordinances and covenants that I made that I didn't feel were necessarily appropriate to talk about from the pulpit. I felt that I scaled it down a lot and tried to be very respectful of people's feelings because my talk was just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there is a lot of stuff that I have not expressed and have not been able to talk to people about. That was just something I wanted to make clear. But you asked what the immediate response was from the congregation. During my talk, I saw that there were many people that were crying. I think I counted at least 8 that just really had tears streaming down their face. And then there were others that were smiling at me and being attentive. And I don't think there were very many people sleeping. I could definitely tell that they were very much paying attention. So afterwards, I was a little bit worried how it would be received. My husband said that he was proud of my courage to speak what was in my heart, and that was a very kind thing of him to say after me. So I was glad when he said that, and then I had to sit through that. Not that it was a bad talk, but I felt terrible having to sit through another talk and then a song and a prayer before getting that feeling that things were okay or that, you know, they weren't going to kick me out for what I said. I was really relieved when the bishop came to me and he smiled and he shook my hand and he said something along the lines that things would be okay. And then he said, you know, just keep working at it and listen to your husband. And I was a little surprised that he said that, wondering if he listened to my talk at all. And I couldn't say anything, but luckily Tori spoke up and he said, Bishop, I don't have any answers either. So I was glad that he said that. But anyway, I felt like the bishop was okay with my talk and he felt, yes, I had some concerns, but it could be worked out. So that was it. And then some people came up to me and thanked me for speaking out loud what they were afraid to say. Some came up just to encourage me and tell me that there was a place for me in the church and that my questions were normal and that I shouldn't give up on the temple. There were also some people who shared their positive temple experiences with me. There were some people that voiced their surprise at my questions that didn't think that I had those doubts. And others said that they'd had similar experiences and were glad that they didn't have to feel alone anymore. So not one of the people who came up to me said that they were offended, but I guess it could be that the people who got offended didn't want to talk to me directly. So I'm not sure how representative the people that came up to me really were of the whole ward. I can only go off of what I've heard from people. And as far as that, the responses were overwhelmingly positive and opened up a discussion for a lot of people. One member actually pulled my husband out in the hallway and gave him money so we could go to the temple. I thought that was really sweet. I mean, my husband, I think he was a little embarrassed and he also can't remember who it was because we're still so new to the ward. So we can't even thank that person. It was, I think, a little bit weird situation for my husband, but that was such a sign for me of how these good LDS people usually respond. They want to help. They are supportive. They're trying to encourage you or help you out. And I felt that most were sympathetic and tried really hard to be understanding. And so I had a good feeling leaving church that day.
I think it's especially beautiful that there were so many who said that they didn't feel alone now that they had heard your talk. Because like you said in your talk, we don't talk about the temple really, which means that if we do have issues, they tend to just get swept under the rug because there's no proper time or place to speak of them unless you go to the temple and go into the celestial room. But even then, that's not really a good time or space to speak of things either. So the immediate response, including from your bishop, was pretty positive. So then, as you wrote on your blog, everything kind of blew up.
Yes, I was very shocked and surprised, to say the least, at what happened next. I left church that Sunday thinking everything was okay, and nothing at all happened during the week. The next Sunday was Easter, which was pretty uneventful until after church. On the way home, my husband told me that the bishop had called him out of class to talk to him about my issues and problems with the temple. I was pissed off immediately. Why on earth would the bishop not talk to me directly? I didn't understand. I thought he was okay with my talk, and I understand that he would have concerns about my questions, which I figured he would call me to talk to him about those, but I did not expect him to go behind my back and talk to my husband instead. Tori reassured me that he had told the bishop to go to me directly and that he hadn't divulged any personal information, for which I was grateful. And he's not the kind of person to do that, so I know that he handled it well. I wasn't mad at him, but I was really upset that the bishop would go through my husband. Tori said that the bishop wanted to talk to me, but he didn't call all that next week either until Saturday night when Tori and I were actually out on a date, so he just left a message on the answering machine for Tori, saying, "Brother McLean, I'd like to talk to you this Sunday. Please bring your wife." So since the message was for Tori, I didn't call the bishop back, and I didn't feel like it was my responsibility to respond to my husband's messages. So Sunday, when we walked into the church, the bishop was waiting in the foyer, and he shook my hand, and then he asked me to come to his office. And then he also asked my husband to come as well and to also bring all our four little girls. And then in the office, things just went downhill. The bishop pretty much accused me of preaching false doctrine from the pulpit, and I was really confused because he hadn't mentioned anything to the effect in the 2 weeks since my talk. I asked why he didn't correct me when I was speaking, to which he replied that he didn't feel it was the right time, but I guess he also didn't feel that it was the right time during the next 2 weeks, and instead pulled me out right before church in front of my whole family. He proceeded to tell me that he had called my previous bishop and stake president, and from one of them found out about my blog on which I discuss my questions and issues with the church. He said that my blog was horrible, that I was teaching false doctrine, and that I was risking my membership in the church. And then he told me that he actually hadn't read any of my blog, but that's just what some of my previous leaders supposedly told him. So I asked him if maybe it would be a better idea for him to actually read it for himself and make up his own mind, and he said that his wife had suggested the same thing. So I'm like, oh, great. So he talked to his wife about me, too. That's just lovely. You know, I just said to him, I don't feel loved or supported by you right now. And he just point blank told me it was not his purpose, but instead he was there to reprimand me. And at that point, I got angry. My girls, the oldest one is 5, the smallest one is 3. They were sitting there watching all of this. And at that point, I think I was just staring at him in disbelief. And I said that I found it absolutely inappropriate that he would call me in to reprimand me in front of my husband and my 4 little girls, and that he had no right to do that. And he maintained that it was his right and his responsibility to do so. And I asked him again why he hadn't done that earlier and in private. And he said he'd try to contact me and work things out, to which I had to say, well, I disagree, because you talk to other people about me behind my back, including previous church leaders and your wife and my own husband. And all his communication was with my husband. And not once did he try to address me directly until that very day. His reply to that was that as the head of the household, he had to ask my husband's permission to speak to me, and that talking to my husband was the same as talking to me.
My goodness.
I mean, I seriously, if I had not heard it myself, I wouldn't have believed it. I said that I was my own person and that talking to my husband about me was in no way the same thing as talking to me. And he just maintained that it was, and that I didn't understand the priesthood correctly. And I just kept reiterating what I felt, because my girls were in there and I wanted them to hear what I had to say and to counteract this. I don't have a good word to describe what I feel the bishop was doing, but I knew that I could not leave it like that. I had to tell my girls what I felt was true. So he then forbid me to bear my testimony. It was Fast Sunday, and said that if I did, he would have me escorted out of the chapel. I totally felt like a criminal. Like, really? You're going to get like 2 burly big priesthood holders that are going to drag me out of the church? So I could tell that at that point, the conversation wasn't going anywhere, and I was really hurt by the spirit in which he was talking to me, and I could just feel myself falling apart. I knew that I wouldn't be able to hold it together much longer, and I didn't want to subject my kids to any more of that. So I said, you know, Bishop, the most loving thing I can do is to just end this conversation right now. And so he said, okay, and we got up. And as we were leaving, he called me back and told me that I had to give him my temple recommend, which I did. And then we left. And I mean, as soon as I walked out of the church, I pretty much broke down crying, sobbing uncontrollably. And Tori put all the kids in the car and said, no, it's okay. I'll go home by myself. You guys can stay here. And he said, no, I'm not going to let you drive by yourself. So he took me home, and then he went back to church with the kids because they wanted to go to primary. So I was alone at home, and I cried literally for hours. And I wrote a blog post about my experience, and I just felt, you know, how dare he try to silence me? So I wrote the post right then, and I posted it that same day, and I didn't feel that I was doing anything wrong. I was very hurt by how he treated me, but I felt that in my post, I was still respectful and talked about the things that happened without name calling or insulting him or judging the kind of person that he is. But I definitely was very upset and disappointed with the way that he treated me. So after posting that, I received an outpouring of love from old and new friends, people that had stumbled across my blog and member friends from Germany that emailed me, and, you know, members here from different wards that came across it and called me. And so I felt like that love that I didn't get from the bishop, I did receive that manyfold from the other people that were really holding me up during that week. And the bishop didn't contact me again all week. So I wasn't planning on attending church the next day, which was Mother's Day, but my girls begged me to come. They told me that they had learned a primary song for Mother's Day, and my oldest one started crying. They said, you have to come or we'll have no one to sing to, Mom. So how could I not go? So I went to church, and luckily the bishop was out of town, so I didn't have to be confronted with that because I wasn't ready for it. And I also left directly after sacrament meeting. So the end of the following week, when I still hadn't heard from the bishop, I wrote a letter to him and the stake president, and in those letters I also included my most recent two blog posts and the comments to those blog posts, and I also put a copy of the letter to my stake president and the letter to my bishop and vice versa, so they knew what I was communicating to each of them. I didn't go to church that Sunday, and now it's yet another week later, and I still haven't heard from either of them. The only communication that I did receive was a call from the bishop, not this past week, but the week before, inviting me to speak with the temple president, which I accepted, but the bishop didn't address anything else in that phone call. So that talk with the temple president was last Sunday. I went home after talking to him. I didn't stay to attend church. The talk with the temple president was pretty good. He is a very, very sweet man. He didn't judge me at all. I felt that he was trying really hard to help me, but we still couldn't really get on the same page. And it was then that I realized whether or not the conversations I had with church leaders and members were in a kind or contentious spirit, one thing was always the same. And the bottom line was always that I just needed to try harder to get the right answers and find the truth. So there was no room for the possibility that maybe my truth would be different from theirs. And that's what I feel is the very nature of this church. It doesn't allow for a perception of truth like the one I have. I do think that I have some relativist leanings, feel a little bit more relativistic to truth rather than absolutist. I feel that there is a God and therefore there is divine truth. But I feel that we as people, organizations, and churches, we can only partially access this truth in a very imperfect and flawed way. I think that there's more than one answer and more than one truth for most of the questions one could ask. And the very premise of Orthodox Mormonism is that that's wrong, and that instead this is the one true church, and there's only one truth and only one prophet and only one way to live. And therefore, my personal relativistic interpretation of truth is usually completely rejected. And that's about what happened up until now.
So you haven't heard back from the stake president then?
I have not. So I don't really know where to go from here. The temple president suggested that I talk to the stake president and that I ask for my temple recommend back for the sole purpose of going to the temple to meet with the temple president again. He said that he would be willing to do that if I still wanted to, so that we could talk in more depth about my questions, about more specific things that I have concerns about in the ordinances, in the covenants. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do, because I haven't heard anything from the stake president. I'm not sure that I want to contact him again, because it might not be helpful. I just feel that if he thought this was a priority, he probably would have contacted me by now. And seeing that he hasn't, I don't know what to make of that. I know he's probably really busy. He probably has a family and a job on top of him being the stake president. So I'm not saying that I should be his priority. However, I feel that there could have been some kind of communication, even if it was just saying, I don't really have time to deal with this right now the way I want to deal with it. So could we maybe make an appointment for whenever, or just something to let me know, I acknowledge that this happened to you, or that he sees this as a problem that needs to be dealt with, or at least telling me, you know what, you're out of line, you should listen to your bishop. And then at least I could say, okay, I gotta leave. I'm not coming back. But this leaving me hanging, you know, in German, there is this expression to let somebody starve on your outstretched arm. That's probably a really bad translation, but I feel like they're trying to keep me close while not giving me what I need. I think they probably know that I want to talk about this again, or that I want some kind of resolution. And I'm wondering if they're just waiting to see how persistent I'm going to be. I don't understand why they haven't responded. I take it day by day. I let myself choose each Sunday whether or not I want to go to church. And today I chose not to. My family's at church right now and I'm by myself at home.
So you don't know what you're planning to do next then?
I have no idea. I probably eventually will contact the stake president, just because I want to confront him and ask him, do you think that this is okay behavior from one of your bishops? I might wait until I feel it's the right time, but I don't think I'm going to leave it at that.
How has this affected you as a woman in the church?
I guess I've realized that I'm not willing to do the mental gymnastics anymore that are necessary to make myself believe that women and men are equal in the church. You know, I've heard this term, I think it was on Feminist Mormon Housewives, somebody said, why do we keep talking about this? I mean, this is total mental gymnastics. It is so obvious that we're not equal. And I know this is different for different people, but for me, this resonated. I was trying to explain this inequality in a way that I could feel okay with it. But the truth is, I don't. And I'm not going to pretend anymore that I do. I know in my heart that God created us equal, but I don't see that implemented in the church. And I used to try and defend my opinion to Orthodox Mormons and citing scriptures and general authorities and all of that. And even though I felt that my arguments were compelling, I hardly ever got through to anyone. And usually those very conservative members and church leaders would just maintain that I didn't understand the doctrine correctly. And of course, it's a possibility that I'm wrong. It happens every day. I'm wrong a lot. But it's just as possible that they're wrong. And I feel like they don't acknowledge that maybe they're wrong, because they have such a strong testimony that they're right, that that is not a possibility. So if you go into a conversation like that, there really isn't a point to having a conversation at all, if you go in thinking that there's nothing you can learn from the other person. So maybe what feels right for me is simply different, but not inherently better or worse than what feels right for them. And so in the end, I just have to ask myself, do I stay in the church pretending to believe in doctrine that makes my very soul cringe inside my body, hoping that it's actually true when I really hope that it's not, and that maybe in 10 or 20 or 50 years I will finally understand? Or do I go with the things that I already have a testimony of, that there is a God who, in my heart, I believe, incorporates male and female, that people were created of equal worth, that love is the only thing that matters in the end, that life is about creating joy, and that my family can be together forever, regardless of temple ordinances. So I personally choose to go with that, the things that I already believe in my heart, and I am open to any truth being added unto that. However, I will not make myself believe anything that doesn't ring true to the core of my being anymore. If it isn't true for me, I will not live it, and I will happily reject even a prophet's counsel if it goes against my own conscience.
That sounds like a strong place of truth.
It sounds good on an hour long podcast, but living it every day is hard.
How is this affecting your family and your husband and your relationships?
Among my family and friends, it's definitely created a lot of good things and some not so good things. And I feel that there are some people who have distanced themselves from me a little, but I feel that's okay. There's many more that have come to me confessing that they felt similar, but didn't dare to speak up. Some relationships have deepened. I've made new friends. I've seen different sides of people that I thought I knew. And I feel more like I am who I truly am. And so I think it gives people around me the assurance that it's also okay for them to be who they are without fear of judgment. With my husband and my kids, it's a lot harder because they're at the core of it all. And they see me struggling and crying and hurting, and that's difficult for them. But they also see me persevering and hoping and sticking up for myself and starting to love my life again. So I think it's definitely an exhausting time for us as a family. And I am looking forward to just having some joy and peace. I try to affirm to my husband that I believe he's a fantastic man, that I totally respect his beliefs. He's been questioning his own motives and beliefs, and I feel that he might be at the beginning of his own journey, of his own struggle of faith. And that's a very scary place to be, and my heart goes out to him. He's very smart. He's got great ideas. He's a very gentle person who would never hurt anybody on purpose. I think he's really spiritual at his core, and I feel that there's a lot about him that I haven't discovered yet. And I feel that me being true to myself hopefully will allow him to be more true to himself. And I don't mean that he has to find issue with the church now and walk away, but I feel that this could be an opportunity for him to strengthen his testimony if this is what is true for him, or that he will find out what his true motives were for being in the church, if it was just because that's the way he was raised, or if he truly believes that this is the truth for him. I don't feel like I'm pushing him either way. I know that my journey affects him because he is starting to doubt his own life or his own testimony. And that can be really uncomfortable and scary, and I don't think he likes it very much. But he doesn't blame me for it either. He understands just as well as I do that this is something I'm doing for myself. I have to figure this out for myself. I'm not trying to take this away from him or my children or anybody else in the family or any other member of the church. I just reserve the right for myself to do what I feel is right, and I hope that in turn gives other people the permission to do the same. Not that they need my permission, but for me, it's always easier to be myself when I'm around people who are genuine and authentic themselves. It's kind of like I'm allowed to be who I am as well. I hope, really, really hope that this is the overall atmosphere in our family right now. I know that this affects the people around me, and I want to stay mindful of that, and I want to stay as kind and loving as I can, but I'm not perfect, and sometimes I just lose it. I get mad at how I've been treated, and now more than ever, I see how we all are works in progress, and I'm starting to be okay with that. You know, after all, that's what repentance and forgiveness and that whole unconditional love thing is for. I have faith that we as a family will pull through this stronger and more united than we are now.
Definitely.
What I really hope for is that at the end that there will be love, and that whatever happens, I will be able to live my life from a place of love. That's the only thing I want out of this.
That's excellent. So as you've gone through all of these different experiences, what are some of the resources that have helped you?
The thing that has helped me is to start writing, to just get my thoughts out of my head. I started my own blog for that purpose. People who have visited that blog and have commented and shared their insights with me, that has been a huge strength. Also, people that have disagreed with me strongly have judged me for the things I said. Especially those people have really challenged me and helped me to see if this is really what I truly felt was right for me, or if I would cave under the pressure of somebody else saying what you're doing is wrong. So that was really helpful and still is very helpful to have this ongoing discussion on my own blog. But then I was just so amazed at all the different Mormon blogs that are out there, that on a lot of them I met people online that understood me, that I could relate to, that made me feel like I wasn't alone, that I wasn't crazy, that I wasn't a bad person or an apostate or a traitor or, you know, I was going to go to hell. The one that I started out with was Feminist Mormon Housewives, which can be a little intense at times and is probably not for everybody. But for me, it was my safe place where I could go to when I wanted to say it the way it was without being judged. I love them for that, and they've been kind of my home base. I also really enjoy The Exponent, which is another great blog of and from and for Mormon women. I like the Sunstone website, the blog, and the different materials that they offer. A newer one that I just recently discovered and started reading, I don't even know how to pronounce it. I think it's called Zelophehad's Daughters. Zelophehad's. Zelophehad's.
Yeah, Zelophehad's Daughters, yeah.
I think they could have picked an easier name, so I wouldn't have to be embarrassed right now, but I think they have great conversations going on over there. I tend to orient myself more towards the Mormon blogs on the internet that are written by and for women that have sort of a feminist approach, because those are some of my most important concerns with the church. I personally wouldn't consider myself a feminist. I guess if I had to pick a label, it would be an egalitarian. I don't just want people to be considered equal when it comes to their gender or their sex. You know, it's just as much about race and nationality and ethnicity and whether or not, you know, they might be disabled or they're maybe old or they are maybe homeless or they are maybe somehow on the fringes of society or not respected. I consider myself more of an egalitarian that way, that I feel that all of us are equal. A lot of my issues, however, are mostly discussed on feminist blogs, so that's where I go. Other than that, I've started doing yoga, which has been really helpful for me to quiet myself and to just feel a connection with God that I hadn't felt like that before. It was really strange when I first, I've only done it for about 6 weeks, and when I first started, I didn't like my teacher, and I wasn't going to listen to all of his psycho-spiritual mumbo-jumbo babble stuff, that I didn't want to have anything to do with that. And then throughout that yoga class, this strange thing happened where I just randomly started crying, and I don't know what happened, but I was releasing some sort of feelings or emotions, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what happened, but I liked it because it was kind of a cleansing experience. Yoga is just a way that makes me feel safe and connected and at peace. So I'm not saying I'm going to do it forever. I'm not saying it's the one thing that will help everybody, but it's been a piece of the puzzle for me, besides, you know, writing things down and talking about my problems with others. I also run because, well, I don't really like doing it. I just do it because I always used to hate it, and I never saw myself as an athletic person. And so I started running to prove to myself that I could do something hard that I never thought I could do. I finished a bunch of different distance races last year. Two of them were half marathons. And so this year I am training for a full marathon, which will be in July.
And this, go you.
Well, I'm really slow. I'm not competitive at all. I'm just doing it to see if I can survive it. And let me tell you, I'm only doing this once. I'm not going to be a marathon runner. This is a one-time thing, but I've just started to get this zest for life again, that I want to try things I haven't tried before, and I want to push myself and challenge myself and think outside the box and reach beyond my comfort zone and reach some of those goals that mean something to me. So part of that was going back to school this semester to finish my degree. And it was really helpful for me to feed my intellectual hunger and having open discussions about controversial topics without being judged for having an opinion. And meeting new people that are not members has helped me see things from a different perspective and gain a richer understanding of what I believe to be true. I enjoy the time that I spend with my girls a lot more. I feel more deeply connected to my husband. I think I put more effort into my relationships with them, but they're also easier at the same time because I don't feel so much boxed in by those expectations of what it's like to be a good wife and a good mother. So I'm a little bit more free to just enjoy spending time with them the way they are. And that has really helped me. My husband's support during this time has meant everything. That I was afraid this would drive us apart. And I can see how it could. But I feel I'm so proud that we are pulling this together and that we are going through this as a couple and that we are helping each other. And in a way, it's the first time that I've truly felt like we are a team. And so, yes, it is hard and it is exhausting and it is a struggle, but I'm so, so grateful for it because I feel that I am closer to him now than I ever was before.
Sounds like you have a very good husband.
I do. He's also very handsome.
So, what are your hopes about participating as a panelist on this podcast?
Well, part of why I wanted to do this is because I still need to make sense of my experience for myself, and writing about it and talking about it helps me personally. I also hope to connect with some like-minded people who I can have those open conversations with without being afraid that my questioning will threaten their testimony. And then lastly, I hope that just maybe someone who's listening will feel less alone and less isolated and less crazy for feeling the way that they do. I have to say that the blog post about my experience with the bishop drew more readers and commenters than any other post that I've written so far. But what was interesting was that the majority of the comments expressing similar frustrations were written anonymously. And many of them have said that they were afraid to speak up and say their real name or come out with their concerns. And they were uncomfortable with others knowing their identity. So I was asking myself, why is it that so many of us are afraid to speak up? If this is God's church, why are we afraid? And why do we not realize that there is something so very wrong with a group, a culture, a church that puts that much fear into its members' hearts about speaking their truth? We live in America where we believe freedom of speech, yet we are so discouraged from speaking freely in the church. And instead of refusing to be silenced, many just comply with it. And I've just asked myself why over and over again. And so that's my main reason for being on the podcast, because I want to ask that question. Why do we let ourselves be silenced? And all I want is for us to explore that question, wherever that may lead.
I really, really resonate with that idea of being able to speak up. That was one of my very primary reasons for starting this, was to finally put a voice to a lot of the things that the women in the church feel and think and have issues with and their experiences and what's happened to them, and that how much of that remains buried under this heavy blanket of fear and it just keeps everything quiet. But I think that we would all feel so much better if we could talk to each other. And I'm so glad that you are part of this podcast and going to be one of our panelists. I've enjoyed so much hearing about your story and hearing all of the crazy aftermath of your very brave and beautiful talk. I hope that this podcast doesn't bring you any more punishment. I hope that there's not a whiplash from it.
You know, there's a possibility that that will happen, but I went into this knowing full well that that's what could happen. And I have to say that I'm not threatened by the risk of being excommunicated. I've heard on many, because I only talk to people about this for not a very long period of time, but this fear of being excommunicated keeps coming up. This is a very real fear for people speaking out, is that they feel there will be some kind of a backlash. They will be disfellowshipped, or they will be excommunicated, or they will be ostracized. And the reason this is a real threat for Mormons, I think, is because being Mormon is so much more than belonging to a religion. A friend of mine on my blog once commented that to him, as an outsider, being Mormon seemed more like being Jewish. It's more like a cultural identity that encompasses your whole life. Your whole life really centers around your faith. And that's not a bad thing. But if this means that you have to conform to the rules of that church, and your whole network is made up of members of the church, and all your friends are Mormons, and your whole family is Mormon, and if you're not, then you won't be together forever. Those threats are very scary and real to a lot of people who would like to speak up and don't feel that they have the strength to do that. And for me, for some reason, I'm not afraid to be excommunicated, because I know that God knows my heart and that I'm not doing anything wrong. I mean, I'm not saying I never make mistakes, but I don't feel that it is wrong for me to speak up. I'm sure that there's plenty of things I could have handled better. And there's many people who criticize me for being so public, for putting this all on my blog and discussing it openly. And all I think is, why not? Why should I not be able to discuss those things? Those are things that really happened. I'm not lying. I'm not trying to talk negatively about the church, but I am definitely trying to add my voice to the experiences of the members in the church. And my experiences haven't all been great, and I want them to be heard, just as much as all those faith-promoting stories of members who were super happy with everything the church does. That's great. That's not the whole story. And so it's very kind of you to say that you don't want this to have any negative backlash for me. And maybe it won't, and maybe it will. And I just want you to know that I came into this knowing that either one of those things could happen, and I am perfectly okay with that.
You're very brave.
Or
you're just
crazy.
Crazy. Crazy or brave. I think you're awesome.
Yeah, every courage is equal parts bravery and craziness, I think, sometimes. So
that's a good mix, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me and for giving real people an opportunity to tell their stories, because I feel that everybody has a story that's worth being heard. And so your podcasts for me are very personal, and it's almost like walking on sacred ground when I listen to somebody tell me their very personal beliefs and feelings. So I know that the people that are speaking, and you yourself, we are all making ourselves very vulnerable doing this. But I feel that this is the only way that true connection can occur, if we allow ourselves to be open and to let other people in. So I am very grateful that you started this. And I love hearing people's voices instead of just reading their story. I love hearing them.
Me too.
I will keep listening.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Julianne. Thank you for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. I invite you to respond at daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com. If you have ideas for future episodes, I'd love to hear about them. Thanks to Kevin McLeod for the music.